And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Certainly, we had a busy program yesterday. Phone lines were jammed, and we were talking about what qualities would you pass on to future generations. What a wonderful conversation we had yesterday. And today, we didn't get to some of the stuff that we did yesterday, so today we're going to continue with some of the questions that we were going to ask yesterday. And the question is Montpelier listening to you? What got me thinking about this question is the $26 million fee bill that is now going through the legislature, and also the provider tax that has been proposed on independent doctors, those independent practices for doctors and dentists. So we'll ask that question coming out of the blocks today. And also we'll speak with Paul Hines, political editor of 7 Days, who's out in Nevada covering the upcoming caucuses in that state. As you know, it's really interesting what's happened in Nevada. Hillary Clinton was way ahead in polls until just recently, and it looks like it's a dead heat now in the Democratic side in Nevada between Clinton and Sanders. And if we have time, I want to explore something that's just an interesting question to me. And that is, towards the end of the program, let's explore Apple's decision to fight in court the U.S. government's attempt to require them to break the encryption code on their iPhone. And what they want to do is the government wants to use this iPhone and they can't get into it in order to get some of the information from the terrorist from the California shootings. But first up, is Montpelier listening to you? If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Is Montpelier listening to you? And to start off this discussion, I'd like to read a Monday editorial that I found in the St. Albans Messenger. If you are interested in opinions out there, I often like to read the Rutland Herald and Times Argus, their opinion, and also the St. Albans Messenger. They seem to have, they put a lot of thought. Sometimes you may not agree with them, but they put a lot of thought into their editorials. And this is out of Monday's St. Albans Messenger editorial. The headline is, 15 extra bucks to get hitched. That's just the beginning. If you are, and here's the editorial, if you are giving thought to tying the knot, and if you have any concern as to what tying the knot might cost, then you would be prudent to tie the knot soon. The legislature is about to make the fateful decision more expensive, as if the increased expense is the cost of a marriage license. Presently, it costs $45. The proposal is to increase it by a third to $60. The Joint Fiscal Office estimates that the increase will raise $81,915 in additional revenue. That's just the beginning. The House Ways and Means Committee has about 300 of these new fees to consider. Together, they would generate almost $26 million in additional state revenue. Almost 50% of the $26 million would be generated by doubling the tax on mutual fund filings. It's a lot of little stuff. If you have a pet shop, the licensing fee jumps from $150 to $175. A milk handler's license for someone dealing with 50 to 10,000 pounds a day doubles from $100 to $200. And the late fee for milk handler's license also doubles from $50 to $100. There is a new fee of $250 imposed on the certification of all small farms. The state liquor department is looking at about $258,577 in new fees. The car registration fee jumps 20% and will generate $585,431 in projected revenue. Proposed fees for everything under transportation totals almost $9 million. There is a 50% increase in the fees that apply to maple dealers and processors. If you're a private applicator of pesticides, then you must pay $25, a fee you've never had to pay before, although we're a bit unsure what a private applicator is. Raising fees is nothing new. It happens every year. It's how the state covers its costs, but this is not a normal fee bill. The cost of mutual fund filing, for example, has not doubled. It's just that the state has figured out it can double its charges, raising $13 million, and be richer for it. Campaign for Vermont has noted that the fee bill before the Ways and Means Committee is contrary to Vermont law. In the late 1990s, legislation was passed to require that any increase in fees be paired with the increase in cost. What is before the legislature is a departure from the law. The state has not seen a $26 million increase in the cost of administering its various programs. There is no mystery to the disproportionate increase being proposed with these 300 fees. It's easier to push through fee increases than it is to raise taxes or cut spending, particularly if no one knows. If you're married, who cares if the license, if you're married, who cares if the license fee jumps $15? If you're not a dairy farmer, who cares if the milk handling fees jump? If you're doubling the mutual fees, if doubling the mutual fees doesn't affect you, then do you care? Isn't that an easy way to raise $13 million? If you don't drink, no one has taken a dime out of your spare change to pay for inspection fees. If you're not a trucker, what do you care if their costs go up? The problem is that whenever anyone's costs go up for any service, it eventually filters down to all of us. People and businesses don't absorb costs without passing them on. Even the extra $15 to get married has to come from somewhere. Why the focus on fees? The state has a spending problem. We habitually spend more than we take in. The problem is political in the sense that the governor steadfastly insists that the budget be balanced without resorting to tax increases. If the budget gap can be plugged by raising $26 million in new fees, then he's kept that promise. Legislators can hide behind the same promise. At some point, this becomes transparently ridiculous. Fees are a cost of doing business. Raise them beyond what is defensible, and the fee becomes a burden taxpayers in general must bear. State spending is still state spending, whether the revenue is being raised through general tax increases or fees. We can't pretend to be more fiscally responsible just because we chose to raise fees to cover the budget deficit rather than to raise taxes or to cut spending. Why is this happening? Because you don't know about it. And that's the editorial from the St. Albans Messenger. And it raises an interesting question. Is Montpelier listening to you? Would appreciate your comments, your opinions on that. The answer to that question, is Montpelier listening to you? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. It also raises another question that government, state government, trying to be too clever to hide from us the aspect of raising revenue, but also sometimes being too clever in how they hide spending as well. And many of you were wondering where I was coming from the other day when I was talking about the governor's Paris expense. And this is where I was coming from. Government trying to hide how much the cost are of particular things. And let me just sort of set this up. In December, Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin traveled to Paris, and he was attending a United Nations climate change conference there. And upon the return, the governor, as usually happens, because we give our governor great latitude in where they can go. The only thing in return that we ask is that there's an accurate accounting of the trip for what Vermont taxpayers pay for in this trip. And the governor came back and he reported that the cost of the trip was about $1,251 for the travel cost of an aide. The administration said, you know, that the governor's lodging and flight was picked up by Georgetown University. And recently, just recently, they stated that he personally picked up the tab for his own meals while he was in Paris. Now, the reported cost of the trip left many shaking their heads in disbelief, including myself, by the way, not because it was too much, but because it seemed too little. And when you examine the cost of that trip, there seems to be a lot left out. For example, there's no detail of the transportation cost of how the governor and his entourage got around Paris. And what about the cost of the security detail? Those are government expenses. Those are taxpayer-funded expenses. The cost is the security detail that accompanied the governor. What was the cost of their travel, their hotel, their meals? That was not listed in terms of the cost of the trip. They certainly are funded by the taxpayer. No one knows these transportation costs or these public safety costs because the administration is refusing to release them, claiming it's a matter of security. Now, this is the first time that I've heard this in terms of trying to keep things under wraps in terms of calling it security. The logic of this seems to escape me of why you would try to keep from releasing these expenses, because if you think about it, if you were any administration and you didn't want any travel expenses or certain travel expenses to be released, you could simply ship them over to public safety and say, hey, look, these are security. We're not going to release these. The second thing is these are expenses of a trip that's been almost 2 months ago. So what sort of security issues are they talking about? And if it's personnel costs, if they don't want to know how many people traveled with the governor in terms of personnel, you can aggregate those numbers. You know, look, if the administration would have come back and said to Vermonters, certainly the governor is traveling with security. Every Vermonter knows that. They see him every day. They see the governor every day. They know that he has security around him. And certainly, a few weeks after the Paris bombings, Vermonters would expect a Vermont governor to have security around them. So why not list the expenses? They are taxpayer expenses. And the only thing you can do, you speculate. When you do not release these sort of expenses, you speculate. And that's the worst thing in politics, is allow people to speculate. And if you speculate, if you try to think what these are about and what are possible explanations for excluding these costs, well, there are two possible explanations: that the administration was nervous with how such a trip would be perceived by Vermonters, so they decided to only disclose some of the cost, but not others. Or secondly, they were nervous or trying to hide something in these expenses that they didn't want to get out. This sort of speculation, these sort of explanations are problematic for the administration, because either way, it looks like they're trying to hide something when, if they only would have disclosed them, they only would have disclosed them up front, it would have been a whole different matter. And by the way, Vermonters would have understood. Now the administration has a problem. The Shumlin administration has a problem because not releasing the total cost of the trip, it leads to all sorts of speculation what is being withheld. And you know from previous experience, this administration has had past problems in being too cute with information, whether it's delaying the single-payer cost or downplaying the Vermont Health Connect problems or reporting only half of the impact of a tax proposal in a budget speech. There is always, and this is something the administration has to overcome, there is always this growing feeling in the public that they're not getting the full story, they're not getting full disclosure of the information. And this withholding of expenses only adds to that perception. You know, in the end, this is an administration who talked and promised transparency. And this sort of goes against it in all sorts of ways because it isn't transparent. And ironically, the lack of transparency is about an issue that most Vermonters would understand. So I certainly don't understand it. Just wondering if Montpelier is listening to you. What a fine editorial in the St. Albans Messenger talking about raising fees that will have an impact on you because you don't know about it. So is Montpelier listening to you? If you have an opinion, a comment, give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Is Montpelier listening to you? They have done a few things in the last few days that if you think are a concern to you and should be a concern to others, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. There's been a lot happening in the legislature. There's been the marijuana bill that is moving. There has been the proposal for a provider tax. There is this $26 million in fees. There is the aspect of whether Montpelier is really listening to you. And, you know, it seems to be sometimes forgotten, at least in Montpelier, that Vermonters still have economic jitters out there. I mean, politically, for Montpelier, it can be tempting to dismiss Vermonters' economic concerns by pointing to national indicators showing an improving job market or highlighting the low unemployment rate. You know, talking up these improving indicators de-emphasizes, at least to me at least, the real underlying economic concerns, many of which, like high tax burdens and other costs, are the result of public policy in Montpelier. There is no doubt that some indicators, and certainly not the stock market the last few weeks, but some indicators have translated to appreciable improvements in the economic security of many Vermonters. I mean, we're not in 2008 when everything sort of turned our economic world upside down. Certainly that recent recession, coupled with other economic events, have had a profound effect on our families in this state. Many of them are jittery. Many of them are downright scared about their economic future. And Montpelier has to recognize that. They got to think about that when they're raising $26 million in fees. They got to think about that when they're talking about the provider tax. They've got to think about that when they're putting extra burden, not only on families, but on small businesses as well. Of course, you know, the backbone of Vermont's economy are the large and the medium and the small businesses that choose, and it is their choice, to locate and conduct business in this state. They make it possible for Vermonters to have jobs and paychecks, and they pay property taxes and income taxes so that local and state government can provide service and jobs. And you know what? In many cases, matter of fact, in a lot of cases, they make generous contributions to nonprofits in this state. And as many of you know, we are a state that has a lot of nonprofits. And those nonprofits provide needed social services for the less fortunate. One of the things that struck me as I was reading all this and as I was thinking about this, you know what? Businesses don't complain a lot. And the only thing they ask for in return, I believe, the business owners, they really ask little of our lawmakers other than a plea not to make it more difficult for them to compete in an increasingly competitive global marketplace. And so my question this morning, starting out of the blocks, is Montpelier listening to you? And when you have things like a $26 million fee bill, when you have things like a proposed provider tax, does that create further hardship in this state? You know, it is interesting that most national surveys show Vermont remains in the top 10 taxed most expensive states. So attempts to get more money from Vermonters or employers can have a negative impact at some point. They can have a negative impact on future job growth in the state. But the impact that it will have most, and lawmakers should think about this, is that it increases the anxiety Vermonters have about their economic future. So my question this morning is, Montpelier listening to you? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Hey, do non-resident property owners in Vermont have to pay a school tax?
They non-property tax?
No, yeah, non-resident.
Non-resident
owners.
Yes, they pay a statewide property tax. If you're talking about if somebody has a, for example, a second home, they're out of state, they have a second home here, they pay a non-resident property tax rate. And that non-resident property tax rate is set by the legislature.
Yeah, but isn't there a town school tax?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It is a non-resident school. It's a non-resident property tax. It pays both municipal and school taxes. But the legislature sets the school rate tax. You're absolutely right, Fred.
Yeah, because my impression is that a lot of the out-of-state property owners might decide they don't want to stay here anymore because it's just too expensive. I mean, it's crazy. You come to this state, you pay a property tax, you don't live here, you pay a self tax. I mean, why would you want to do it? I mean, it's a pretty state, but gee whiz. I guess the bottom line is, how much is it going to cost? And is there any statistics on how many out-of-state property owners are there and how much money do they put into the state coffers? Is it, 10%, 5%? How big is it? Is it substantial? I wonder about that.
Yeah, Fred, that's an interesting question. And certainly they do provide a lot of money into the coffers, into the statewide property tax that comes in, and local government as well. I do not have the precise numbers to that, but thank you for your call, Fred. Let's go to George in Waterbury. George, you're on Open Mic. Good morning. Is Montpelier listening to you?
Yes, good morning, Mike. What a provocative topic that you bring. I just couldn't help but contributing to this. I mean, in some ways, you're answering your own question, aren't you?
George, I never tried to lead my audience.
Well, I mean, it's so obvious that the majority of the state government has virtually gone out of touch. I mean, not all. But the consequence of the economic free fall that we're in here is, you know, they don't have money they don't have the money to back up the funding for all the entitlements that are required to run this state. And now they're going to try to get them somewhere else. You know, you talk about Shumlin with, you know, being non-transparent. I mean, his transparency in his personal life started before he was even governor. You know, when he tries to get out of a speeding ticket in Putney by showing the officer his Senate card. I mean, come on. I mean, there's things like that that I'm not saying that this is equitable, but it just really stinks. And, you know, so where we're sitting right now is a fiscal responsibility. I'm absolutely convinced that the only way that this is going to turn around is that, you know, the majority of the legislators have got to come to a different conclusion, because you're not going to change it with the present way of thinking. So, you know, they're listening, but they're not acting. And, you know, and the only way it's going to change is for people that have the concern to kind of get involved. And that's a real hard thing for, you know, the average guy that's kind of working and trying to pull the wagon on his own here. So, I mean, what do you think about that?
I think you've hit the nail on the head here, and I think that... You know, George, I was being a little bit facetious when I said I'm not trying to lead the audience. I think the audience is there. There's a concern out there. There is a...
Big concern, Mike. Huge. Big. I mean, the type of people that I'm getting closer to retirement age, the circle of my social economic circle, I see fellows that I've worked with, and their kids have just completed college. They can't get work here, equitable work. And I've spoken with my representatives, and I've had answers that some of them believe that the answer is within. Sure, you need good education, but throwing more money at it, I mean, what's wrong with the idea of saying, how about attracting people to come to Vermont as opposed to solving it from within? You don't need to worry about the economy, because if you don't have an economy, all the money you throw in the world is not going to make a difference, as you know that. So, you know, we're in economic freefall, Mike, and I've said this before. You know, it's not the fall that hurts, it's a sudden stop, and I don't know when that's going to happen.
Thanks, George.
What do you think?
Thank you, George. Thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Andrew in Williston. Andrew, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. In direct answer to your question about do my legislators listen to me or does Montpelier listen to me, it's a categorical no. In fact, my representative specifically said to me when I asked him, he said, I'm in Montpelier to vote my conscience, I'm not going to listen to you, I'm going to vote my conscience. And unfortunately, most of our legislators don't feel any sort of accountability because so few people actually ask them questions or press them for answers. And that's why we have the situation that we have. The electorate here continually baffles me that they'll simply vote for somebody because they have a D next to their name, because the mainstream media tends to vilify anybody who has an R next to their name. And therefore, there's no accountability. We continue to go down this road of the government can fix everything, just give us all of your money and we'll fix everything, and people buy into it. And we never ask the hard questions that you just laid out, that were outlined in the editorial in the newspaper that you called out. And really, for me, I have a 15-year-old child. When he's done with high school, I'm gone. I can't sustain this anymore. I can't live here anymore. I already had to go work for a company out of state so that I can provide for my family. I'm driving up and down 89 every single week just to be able to make ends meet and whatever. I'm not doing it anymore, and they're going to lose this. They're going to lose my tax revenue when I leave.
Andrew, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Rich in Huntington. Rich, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. You know, I've brought this up before on your show, but I think because of, I don't know what else to call it, but liberal peer pressure, there seems to be this paranoia among the voting public in Vermont that to behave in any way other than is consistent with the progressive worldview makes them bigoted, hateful, insensitive, right on down the line. And I think this paranoia even seems to follow people into the voting booth when there's a curtain drawn behind them, that God forbid in their sleep they might blurt out that that they voted for a Republican, and then what are the neighbors going to think? Mm-hmm. So we have this mindset of just going in and voting party line, and this is the result. And I think the people in Montpelier, there is no need for them to be responsive because they know this is the way people behave.
You know, that's an interesting sort of observation, Rich, but don't you think it comes to a point where people vote their pocketbook?
I would like to think so, but I think this liberal peer pressure is so powerful. Like I said, I think it even follows people into the anonymity of the voting booth that they just cannot seem to vote something that makes total sense and in their self-interest. Not to say that you should vote for selfish reasons, but, I mean, our economy is going down the toilet, and that's not good for anybody. And I just see that, that liberalism in general, it's like alcoholism. You're not going to admit you have a problem until you've completely hit bottom.
Thanks for the phone call, Rich. I appreciate it. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Well, we certainly have touched a nerve here when we're asking, is Montpelier listening to you? Phone lines have been buzzing here. Want to get right back to them, and let's go to Jim. Jim, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you this morning?
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I think you definitely stirred up the hornet's nest with this subject. you talk about state representatives. That's pretty much become a contradiction of terms. You know, when we go and we listen to these people run for office and their spiel, and you know, listen, when we vote for them with them people thinking that they've got our best interests in mind, what we believe in, and then they know someone to get in there and they represent their own special interests. So the term of a representative is no longer a valid term in this state. And they don't listen. I mean, I looked at the legislature, and they are out of touch with reality of what's happened economically in Vermont. I own a business. I have 15 employees, full-time employees. Okay, and I'll give you a perfect example. Cost of business in the state of Vermont. When Sneaky Pete decided he was going to run healthcare better than the private industry could and get involved in it, a policy that I paid $350 a month for my employees, and I paid 100% of it. We paid 100% of it for our employees, made sure they had healthcare. That policy went up overnight, $120 a month. So this is no longer affordable. And this is just a good example where the businesses didn't want this type of state-run health care. We knew it wouldn't be affordable. I don't understand why Montpelier thought it was going to be affordable, because it isn't. It's more expensive now. And if you talk to a lot of small employers in this state, I'll almost guarantee you there are a lot less employees being insured by their employer now than there was before Peter Sumlin stuck his fingers into the insurance business. So that's, you know, and we all told our legislators we were against this type of thing because we knew what would happen, and it did happen. You know, and again, like I said, I mean, going to vote for these people is almost a waste of time because they don't represent, you know, small industry. They don't represent, you know, the everyday people. A lot of them are self-serve, and that's what it's become, in my opinion.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Paul. Paul, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I'm going to follow up on that conversation with one similar. I think part of the problem is there's not enough voices being heard down there at all in terms of dissent or different opinions and views. And though I can just cite that by talking about the newly passed paid sick leave bill. The day I found out about that was a neighboring business to mine, a gentleman who actually runs it, who was on a committee. He was the only business that was part of the committee, and he was on this committee with a bunch of college students, just graduated college students, who, for the most part, I know for a fact, never owned a business. Most of them had never really worked full-time in their life. And yet, they're the ones who are coming up with the new policy that was going to become this bill. And I looked and I said, well, why am I not on that committee? And he says, Paul, you would never make it because people don't want to hear from you. And he was very clear. He says, you're very much a conservative. And he says, I'm much more of a liberal, so more than likely they're going to hear what I have to say. The point being is that there aren't enough dissenting views down there. And because of that, particularly to my business, I am going to be out thousands of dollars. And that is even with Governor Sumlin coming on and saying it's only $400 a year at most of the cost of people. Well, that's based upon only having one employee at $10 an hour. I pay $14 an hour to one employee, $16 to another, and $17 to a third. That's going to cost me almost $2,000 a year. Add that to the new fees, add that to the health care that's gone up 70%, and it's no longer just $400. It's thousands of dollars that I may not be able to afford, which means in the future I may have to let people go and just pay minimum wage as opposed to paying livable wages that I thought, you know, I was doing the right thing by giving that kind of money out.
Paul, thank you for your phone call. Great phone call. Let's go to Jerry in Callis. Jerry, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes. If this 26, what did you say it
26
was?
Million.
Fees comes to pass, it's going to make such an impact on everyone that is small businesses, even right down to people that are retired. And you know what? I foresee that these people, like the gentleman said, that as soon as his son graduates from high school, he's out of Vermont. You're going to see a lot of people that are still working that will leave Vermont. And also, you're going to find that retirees that are living here and always have born and brought up in here will be leaving Vermont because of this impact. And for me, I don't think that, obviously, Montpelier is not listening to any of us. And you can make a phone call or email or just call them up and try to talk some sense into them, and they don't listen to you. They don't listen to you. And they'll get their way because they always do. And when that happens, they're going to find a lot of people that will not be paying all of these taxes, high taxes and fees, because they won't any longer be in Vermont. That's all I got to say.
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks for the phone call. What we're asking this morning is Montpelier listening to you? And what sort of generated this discussion is the fee bill that is going through, $26 million in additional state revenues. The fee bill is an annual occurrence, but it's usually tied to those things that are going up in cost. So you put a fee, it's a service, you put a fee. But this year it's a little bit different. And the question in the editorial that I wrote, that I read to you, 15 extra bucks to get hitched, that's just the beginning. The question is, why is this happening? Because you don't know about it. And one of the things that I'm asking listeners out there, and the phone lines have been pretty jammed, we've covered most of the phone lines, so if you still have a comment, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Give us a call. We'll be back in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. We certainly have lit up the phone lines this morning. And the question I have been asking is Montpelier listening to you? And what I started out the top of the hour talking about is a editorial that was written by Emerson Lynn from the St. Albans Messenger. And it talks about the $26 million in additional state revenue that's being proposed to be raised through fees. And I'm just going to read you the end of it. I read in the top of the hour the whole editorial, but I'm just going to read the end of it. Why the focus on fees? The state has a spending problem. We habitually spend more than we take in. The problem is political in the sense that the governor steadfastly insists that the budget be balanced without resorting to tax increase. If the budget gap can be plugged by raising $26 million in new fees, then he's kept his promise. Legislators can hide behind the same promise. At some point, this becomes transparently ridiculous. Fees are a cost of doing business. Raise them beyond what is defensible, which the editorial says is in many cases here, and the fee becomes a burden taxpayers must bear. State spending is still state spending, whether the revenue is being raised through general tax increases or fees. We can't pretend to be more fiscally responsible just because we choose to raise fees to cover the budget deficit rather than to raise taxes or cut spending. Why is this happening? Because you don't know about it. That's the conclusion of the editorial. So we're asking you this morning, and the phone lines are jammed up. We're talking about, is Montpelier listening to you? Let's go to Mark in Grand Isle. Mark, you're on open mic.
Hey, good morning, Mike. I just want to say I love your show. You're really doing a great service to all of us out here trying to survive in this liberal society. Along with the this $26 million tax increase is the Bill H-46, which establishes the regional council governments, which is a grab at local control, similar to the what they've done with the wastewater regulations and other funding sources like schools. They're making a grab for local control, and will do away with the select boards eventually as they take over. I think that's something I haven't heard a lot of talk about, and people are just not aware. It went off committee last year and came back out this year with a vengeance.
And Mark, just so I'm confused, you're not talking about Act 46, the school consolidation. No. You're talking H-46. And what does H-46 do? Because I'm unfamiliar with this.
H-246 establishes a regional council of governments. That's what it'll be taking over from what is now the regional, in our case, it's Northwest Regional Planning Commission. And they assist with our local planning documents and stuff like that. And what this regional council of governments will do is it will combine, I think we have 11 towns in our Northwest regional planning, and they will eventually start to take over the jobs of the select boards that are in our towns. So that our town will be represented by one person on this board instead of five people at the table in our town.
Hey, Mark, thanks for alerting me to it. I have not read H-246, but I will just to familiarize myself. Thank you for the phone call. Jack in Bridgeport. Jack in Bridgeport. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
My wife and I are retired, and we live on a couple small pensions and Social Security. Of course, we got no increase in Social Security last year, but our property taxes went up 12.5%. And I admit, you know, that the fuel prices are down this year. But how does someone like us keep up with things like that?
Yeah, but I bet your health care costs are not down. And if you're retired, those are usually a substantial portion of your expenses, aren't they, Jack?
Well, we seem to be pretty healthy, and fortunately. And I have some pretty good coverage from where I worked, which is a godsend. And so on, but I'm talking about property tax.
Yeah, you know,
12.5% increase from year to year, and it seems like it's every year. Nobody's listening to that, I don't think, over there.
Hey, Jack, thank you so much for your phone call. Let's go to Gene in Barrie. Gene, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. A nice sunny morning.
Finally.
Thank you for your service too. I want to point out the legislature. Well. You know, off and on, they're good. But I want to point out, make a thing of the politicians. Remember Green Mountain Power was supposed to, a couple years ago, pay the people back?
Mm-hmm.
Thing? And legislature approved it. They said, yes, Green Mountain Power should. But Governor Shumlin said, no, they don't have to. So we didn't get it back. Your big politicians are big for corporations, not for us.
Thanks.
You know, in Washington, it's the same way. How do you think all these get to be millionaires? They're paid off by the corporations.
Thanks.
Who vote for them so they can do what they want.
Thanks, Gene. Thank you for your phone call. But let's go to Burlington. Burlington, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi. I'm just calling with a comment. And my sense is that this two-party system we have is broken and has been for a long time. It's kind of tribal. And lacks critical thinking. Common core programs in our schools are not helping, so I forecast that the future is not going to be much better in terms of critical thinking skills. This tribal mentality of liberal versus conservative when I was taught critical thinking skills, when I start to label myself, I need to understand that that is a bias on my part, and I really need to open my mind to other thinking, which is very lacking in our culture these days. And the liberal media or the conservative media on the other side, neither are helping this. If you talk about what American exceptionalism is, it's really that we encourage our population to be that way and not diametrically opposed.
Can I ask a question? Because you've sort of piqued my interest here. What would be a better system?
A better system would be an educated population that understands critical thinking skills. And encourages debate, respectful debate, and I think the media has really played a role in this, significant role, to really force people to the extremes, plant their flag, and just not think through the problems that we face in a critical manner. If you believe in democracy, and what the founders were getting at, it's really a spiritual democracy where we go inward and we come out with the right answers. We don't suppose that we have the right answers when we go in. We suppose that I could be wrong. That should be on the end of every sentence when you're in a debate. I believe this strongly, but I could be wrong, and really mean that, and then listen.
You know what I find? We're running out of time, but I find your sort of observations, your thinking fascinating in this regard. What do you think? What do you think about sort of the presidential coverage and the presidential debates? And we've only got about a minute. I'm sorry to do that to you, but what is your impression of those?
It's tribal, and it really insults the intelligence of people who can see the better way. The easy path is to plant your flag, and that wave is just dominating every piece. And folks that really want to have this conversation are not encouraged to get into the system, and when they are, their past is dug up and dragged through the sewer, and that's it's unfortunate. And I'm not seeing, like I said, the forecast, I think, is not terribly good.
Thank you for your phone call. This whole conversation I have found fascinating, and thank you all for your phone calls. Is Montpelier listening? I think we've got to conclude that on the economic and fiscal side, there's a lot that they've got to be listening to in terms of Vermonters. Coming up, a check with our friends at Talk Media News. And then Paul Hines, the 7 Days political editor. He's out in Nevada. And we'll be talking about the caucuses that are out there, and how Bernie Sanders has sort of caught fire out there and closed the gap with Hillary Clinton. And of course, if you ever want to sort of listen to this podcast or this broadcast or any other broadcast of Open Mic, you can go to the WDEVradio.com website and click on the Open Mic podcast. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News, AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barry, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And as I said, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. At this time in our program, we check in with our friends and colleagues at Talk Media News. And on the line this morning is Bob Ney from Talk Media News. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thank you. Yesterday I found it a little bit fascinating because for the first time, Ted Cruz came out on the stage and did what I would call a rapper microphone drop on Donald Trump, saying, "Okay, go ahead and sue me," and then and sort of called him out on that. Is that something that we're going to see more and more of, just taking on the Donald the way that Ted Cruz did yesterday?
Well, yes. I mean, Ted Cruz is doing it. A lot of people hesitated to do it, but, he did it. Trump will do it back. He'll do it back. Cruz is, he's not going to shy away from anything. But this whole lawsuit stuff, I mean, John Boehner, the former speaker, remember he was suing the president?
Mm-hmm.
This is, honestly, in politics, you just don't sue people. You file ethics charges. with the unfair information or whatever, you can do that. But, you know, you don't tend to sue. But I thought it was a very interesting thing that it's been raised like this. But Cruz and Trump are going to go at it. Frankly, people will say, oh, these two, it might benefit them. They continue to be in the news. Not Rubio, not Kasich, not Carson. Mm-hmm. Of course, certainly not Jeb Bush. He finished this race day and out. But I'm just saying that, you know, this is getting the news attention.
You had sort of thought early on that Donald Trump would go far in the primary. Do you still have that feeling?
Oh, yes. Donald Trump will walk into the convention, I predict, with the greatest percentage of delegates. Now, I'm not saying he has enough,
mm-hmm.
but he will walk in with a bigger percentage, I think. I've always felt that. I think he is now to the point where I don't care if he and Cruz are tied nationwide. You know, he's going to win Nevada. He's going to come into the Midwest. Kasich's a factor in Ohio, but you know, Trump is going to win South Carolina, and he's going to win Nevada. So I think he doesn't have clear-cut the amount of delegates needed. You haven't reached that magic number, but I think he's going to go into the convention. Then it's all kinds of deals and maybe five rounds of voting. Who knows?
One of the things that caught my attention overnight was a Fed official saying maybe the bank, this sounded like Bernie actually, maybe the banks are too big. It was the Federal Reserve Bank president of mm-hmm. Minneapolis, the bank president. And he said basically, you know, maybe the banks are getting too big, the too big to fail sort of concept, and maybe we have to break them up a little bit. And I was wondering if that is something that is prevalent out there.
Its day will come. Now, here's the problem with the banks. The way they have these federal charters, if I'm president of a bank and I get in trouble and they go after me, the whole bank goes down. This is a 10-minute fix by Congress where it says, you know, if you're president of the bank or whatever, you can be prosecuted, you can be locked up, you know, next to Bernie Madoff forever, and the bank continues. Why? Who linked all this stuff together, you know? Mm-hmm. Why is a bank too big to fail, and they've always protected the, you know, interest within the bank, and they don't want it failing, so therefore they won't have certain criminal charges, but banks pay fines. Well, where do they get that money from? I mean, this whole issue one day is going to be, I think, clarified.
You know, one of the things that I want to talk about is Apple and the federal government, mm-hmm. but we have a phone call. You must have a fan base up here in Vermont. We have a phone call from Dale in Burlington. He wants to talk to you. Dale, you're on.
Hey, thanks. Yes, thanks for taking my call. I am a big fan of Bob Ney. I really respect what he's done through the years and how he came back from a few issues, et cetera, and I really, really thanks. Expect his opinions coming out of the Washington Beltway. I just have one quick question for him. Do you feel that President Obama has failed or has again proven that he is the great divider instead of the great uniter by deciding to skip the funeral for Judge Scalia?
Thanks, Dale.
Thanks, and thanks for the nice compliments. And I have to tell you, this call, I think, is a really critical call. This isn't a trite thing. The president, unless he has a valid excuse, has no business missing this funeral under any circumstances. None. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And what message does it send, Bob?
Well, I think the caller has used the word divider. It's pure politics. Look, Mitch McConnell made a mistake. He really did. He should have said, Mr. President, you go ahead and appoint, and we're going to make a decision. We're going to keep an open mind. Then he can go ahead and down the appointee if he wants. Mitch injected all these politics, and, you know, that's a bad calculated move. He should have said it different. Putting all of that aside, that's irrelevant. This is a, you know, there's presidents that have went to justices' funerals when they were opposite political parties or they didn't appoint them. I can't find a valid reason in my mind, and I think the caller really is going to hit a nerve. What he's saying hits a nerve. I can't find a valid point in my mind why the president would not go to that funeral. And if he's golfing or a fundraiser, oh my, hang on, you know.
Yeah, that's
there's no valid reason. He could have went. It would have been a wonderful sign.
Dale, good question. Thank you for the phone call. Yeah, let's go to Apple. And Apple and the federal government banging heads over the fact that Apple does, the federal government wants them to help them with their encryption software in their iPhone. And what they want is to get some of the messages of this shooter in California that shot so many people in San Bernardino. And Apple has said, we don't want to do that because that's a master key to our encryption data, and it's a backdoor master key to our whole thing. What's your take on this?
Well, I'm going to give you my mindset. Butch Otter, Ron Paul, and I were the only three Republicans that voted against the Patriot Act. I was called an Osama bin Laden supporter. You know, Bernie Sanders on the other side, he voted as I did too. Those were votes that were tough at the time, but when you look back at the history, and I mention this because I have skepticism in my mind, that's why I voted against the Patriot Act, of how it would be carried out. Having said that, I am extremely skeptic of this. Why, since 2001, has the government only now said, that cell phone, we need to look inside of it? What about all the other cell phones in all history since 2001? You know, what's in there that, you know, this guy's connected and they have proof of the leader of ISIS? I don't think so, but my suspicion is the government wants this developed to be able to go into every cell phone on planet Earth, is my suspicion. They can't do it. They need Apple to do it. If it was a matter of Apple taking the phone and looking at it, this probably wouldn't be a problem. I think Apple is terrified to create something that gets out. I mean, after all, Edward Snowden took how many secrets out? So somebody's going to think that if Apple creates this unique device that can look at every phone on Earth, that it's going to be protected? I mean, really?
Yeah, that seems to be, I mean, Tim Cook has taken a hard line on this and basically said, there's no way we're going to open up this back door, because it opens up the back door to
everything
coming in. And it's not only the U.S. government that may take advantage of this back door. It may be other governments as well.
Oh, they could get into everything we own in America, another government. I mean, this stuff gets out. Look at Edward Snowden. You know, they could create this, and there's another Snowden that moves to China. You know, mm-hmm. Who knows?
Hey, Bob, as always, I enjoy having you on, and thank you so much for being here. That's Bob Ney from Talk Media News. Up next, Paul Hines, 7 Days political editor, who's out in Nevada, and he'll give us his opinions about what's happening out there. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Of course, that Tom, thank you. That's Supertramp, one of the best albums of all time. I really enjoy that album. On the line is Paul Hines, 7 Days political editor. He's out in Nevada. Good morning, Paul.
Viva Las Vegas.
I just want to know what kind of expense account that Paula and Pamela have given you out there.
Oh, it's unlimited, actually. They might not know that yet, but, just got back from the poker table a few minutes ago, so, already lost all my money.
Hey, why are you in Nevada? Something happening out there?
That is a very good question. What am I doing here? I'm out here because the Democratic presidential caucuses are taking place on Saturday, and so I'm covering our Senator Bernie Sanders, and it's shaping up to be a pretty interesting and presumably pretty tight race, although Nevada doesn't have a great history of polling, so there's not a lot of data to work with. But it does seem like it's going to be hotly contested, like all of these primaries and caucuses have been so far. And I think it's going to be a pretty important one for him as well.
You know, I know you got in late last night, but the race, as you said, the race is close. I mean, polls are showing that it's closing. Is there a factor why it's tightening out there, or is it just the national phenomena, from your opinion?
Well, yeah, and I as you mentioned, I just got here very late last night, so I haven't actually really talked to any real people here, so my my on-the-ground knowledge is pretty limited at this point. I would guess that there are a couple of factors here. One is we've seen that Sanders trailed in most places before people actually got to know him. and it's taken him a lot longer because he's not Hillary Clinton, but he has really saturated the airwaves with television advertising. You know, he did that in Iowa, he did that in New Hampshire, and he's been doing that in Nevada. If I'm not mistaken, he was heavily outspending Clinton here for a few weeks. I believe she's now back with more television advertising at the moment. But you know, I think it just took people longer to get to know him, and we're seeing kind of a similar dynamic from other states playing out here. He's obviously spent less time here, but so has Secretary Clinton. You know, he's also Senator Sanders has also invested a lot of time and energy into courting Black and Latino voters. You know, not to overly generalize things, but more so Black voters in South Carolina and more so Hispanic voters here in Las Vegas. And it seems like he's having some success with that, but it's, you know, it won't be clear, of course, till the caucuses how much success.
You know, that's an interesting segue into one of the questions I was going to ask. Is Harry Reid reportedly behind the scenes teed off on the Hillary Clinton campaign because she had said, or her campaign had said, well, you know, Nevada really isn't a good indicator of minority votes and how Bernie Sanders can attract minority votes because it's 80% white. And that sort of teed off Senator Harry Reid because he brought the Nevada caucuses up, you know, moved them in the schedule because of that precise reason, that they are indicative of some of the minority votes that are out there in the country. Does that sound like Hillary Clinton's really worried about this this caucus?
Well, I think it's just classic expectations managing on her part. You know, we've seen this before, and I think the clear message they've been sending for the last 2 weeks is, well, you know, if Bernie Sanders does well, it's just because there are a lot of white people there, right? But that's a very different message from what the Clinton campaign and others said early on, which was that, you know, Bernie Sanders can only compete in Iowa and New Hampshire because they're both heavily white. As soon as he gets to a more diverse place like Nevada and like South Carolina, he's going to run into some real trouble. So I think what they're seeing is they're seeing he's finding success in Nevada, and they don't want to undermine their own argument. Now, I would point out that what the Clinton campaign said recently does have a bit of validity to it, in that you know, this is a heavily Latino state, but if you actually look at the entrance polls, I believe, from the 2008 caucus, only about 15% of the voting electorate in the Democratic caucus was Latino, 15% was African-American, and then about 65% was white. So yeah, more diverse for sure than New Hampshire and Iowa, not as diverse as South Carolina.
The caucus system, of course, is different than what we saw as a primary in New Hampshire. Paul, you may not know this, but I'm going to ask you anyways. Is it different than Iowa? Or is it different than Iowa or not?
Well, you know, I think the main difference, from what I understand, is that this state just doesn't have a history of caucusing. It doesn't have a history of being the first, you know, one of the early states. It has only held a influential caucus once before, on the Democratic side in 2008. And so I don't think there's as much awareness about this caucus. Turnout is not expected to be as high. So I think there will be some differences, but I think it would be impossible to guess at this point who that really benefits. I mean, you know, there's sort of a narrative in the national media that Sanders would do better in caucuses because it takes more energy. And he seems to have more energetic supporters. But, of course, the only real data we have so far is that Clinton won the one caucus that has been held and Sanders won the one primary that's been held. So I think we need to see a few more states play out before we jump to conclusions about, you know, their respective strengths in primaries and caucuses.
We're speaking with Paul Hines, the political editor of 7 Days. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Paul, I'm curious, is there any changes in how you have been allowed to cover Bernie Sanders as he's become more and more popular in the country?
Allowed by bosses or allowed by...
No, allowed by the campaign itself.
Yeah, I mean, there have been pretty huge changes, and many of them are logistical. You know, the guy is huge now, so he travels with a big entourage. There's a huge contingent of media who travel with him. I mean, the first time that I sort of followed him around on a presidential-ish trip was, I think, September 2014, when he made his second visit to Iowa. It was, you know, well before he had officially joined the race, but he was kind of testing the waters. And at that point, you know, he was in a car. He was in, like, a rental car with his wife Jane and Phil Fermonti and Michael Briggs, two aides. And they were just, you know, coasting around the state by themselves. I was in a rental car kind of stalking them. And there really wasn't much in the way of national media. Now, I will say that Senator Sanders wasn't all that eager to talk to me back then, so it's not like I've lost much access. I found him to be tremendously unresponsive to our requests for interviews 7 days, and not just the 7 days, but I've heard this from other Vermont news organizations that he basically just hasn't given any access to any Vermont media since the start of this thing, with the exception of the television stations shortly before the New Hampshire primary, because of course they have some they have many viewers in New Hampshire. Now things have changed significantly in the last few weeks. Out in Iowa before the caucuses, he suddenly had a press bus which was carting around, you know, about a dozen national reporters. By the time we got to New Hampshire, he was traveling in a Secret Service convoy, which was quite different. And then now, since New Hampshire, he's basically been on chartered planes going from state to state. And this is sort of necessary at this stage of the race because he can't just hang out in a state for a week at a time. He's trying to hop around to the different Super Tuesday states and, you know, really not staying in a city for more than half a day at a time. So actually, later tonight, I'm going to be getting on the press plane, or I think it's just one plane for everyone, to start a day-and-a-half-long tour of Nevada. So it'll fly to Elko, which is in the north, and then the Reno area tomorrow, and then back to Las Vegas tomorrow night. So pretty different.
It is. It sounds a lot different. Before we turn to your column, just the expectations are that it's going to be a close race in Nevada, but the expectations are not the same in South Carolina. It seems like Hillary Clinton is holding her lead, primarily because Bernie hasn't shaken away the African-American vote from Hillary Clinton. Any insight into what the Sanders campaign is thinking about South Carolina?
I don't really have a lot of insight into that at the moment. I mean, I do think that much will depend on Nevada. You know, it's very difficult to look at each of these states in isolation because one result tends to build on the previous result. So, you know, I think if you see him doing well and winning in Nevada, I think that helps him quite a bit in South Carolina. We'll have another week of, you know, negative headlines about the Clinton campaign. More voters in South Carolina will get to know him, and because we'll be talking about his win. So I think that the first thing up is Nevada, and I think he has to do really well here. You know, I don't know that he needs to win necessarily, but if he does, it would put him in a pretty good position moving on to South Carolina. And then the really tough phase of the race, which is Super Tuesday and beyond. That's March 1st, our town meeting day. We are one of 11 states that will vote that day.
We're speaking with Paul Heinz, who's the political editor of 7 Days. If you have an opinion, comment, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Turning to your column, I found fascinating that, you know, we've been talking about four candidates for governor. We've been talking about Scott and Lissman on the Republican side, and we've been talking about Minter and Dunn on the Democratic side, but you added more people in your column today.
Well, I would say they're adding themselves. I'm just facilitating it. It looks like there is definitely some space for more Democratic candidates, at the very least. I'm not really seeing more Republicans getting into the race. I think that, for the most part, most people in the party think that Phil Scott is the candidate to beat. But on the Democratic side, there are three people who appear at least open to the prospect of joining, and some seem like they definitely will. So I'll start with the. Why don't we go least likely to most likely? Least likely is House Speaker Shap Smith. You've seen his name before, and with regard to this race, he was in there. He was one of the first to officially announce last summer, and of course he suspended his campaign last fall because his wife was ill. Now he people close to him, his friends, his allies, have been talking up the prospect of him getting back into the race. His wife's cancer treatments are, to my understanding, going to be concluding soon, and things seem to be going as well as they could be. So people want to get back either into the gubernatorial race or potentially into the lieutenant gubernatorial race. When I asked him about it, he definitely didn't say no. And I think that Chad Smith would say no if he was not really thinking about it. So it's unclear on when he'll decide that. Obviously, I think there are a lot of factors that are not political here, but he could be a strong candidate if he gets back into the race.
Let me ask you this before we jump sure. into the next candidate that you're going to talk about. Is there dissatisfaction with the present candidates that are in there? That's why we're starting to hear about this? Or are these people that have always aspired for governor and think it's their time?
I don't know that I would go so far as to say dissatisfaction, but I don't get the sense that either of the two candidates in the race have really locked things up. I think, and this is just a totally subjective sense, but it seems like people are, they're okay with the candidates. Some of them like them quite a bit, but there's room. I think in a Democratic primary in this state, there's always going to be room for more than just two candidates. And in fact, one place where I think there's going to be definitely more room is to the left of Minter and Dunn, and that's where the other two candidates that are talking about it seem to be. Looking. They're looking at running to the left of them. So the next one is John Moran. He's a former state representative from Wardsboro. Not super well known. He was in the House for 8 years. And he, when I interviewed him, he really sounded like he was Bernie Sanders. I mean, he was talking about the political revolution. He was talking about how the rich keep getting richer, the poor keep getting poorer. I think he sounds very much inspired by what we're seeing in the presidential race. And wants to provide that more liberal, progressive alternative. And then the final candidate is Peter Galbraith, former state senator, former ambassador. I think he is the most likely of these three to get into the race. He's been talking about it for a long time now. He's been meeting with people lately. And in fact, he even spoke at an AFL-CIO conference 2 weeks ago where he was billed as, I think, potential or possible gubernatorial candidate. Again, something you don't do if you're not actually serious about running for governor.
We've been speaking the last couple of months about Senator Sanders, but we have another senator, Senator Leahy, and he's finally getting attention with the death of Scalia, and he had a press conference that you covered. What did you find out?
Well, as I wrote in my column, I think that Senator Leahy is looking forward to being in the mix in this confirmation fight. He was quick out of the gate saying that the Senate needs to confirm President Obama's nominee. He has been all over the television. I mean, I didn't write this in my column, but I think it's the first time, at least in quite a while, where both of Vermont's senators were on the Sunday morning talk shows on the same weekend. Which is, I think, just sort of an interesting indicator of their relevance in the discussion these days. Leahy will obviously be really central to the Democratic efforts to get a nominee through. And so he spoke about that Monday at that press conference.
Of course, the Republicans are saying the Democrats are no strangers to filibustering Supreme Court nominees. They cite Alito for such a, for a long time. What's the comeback to that Leahy's talking about?
Well, I think that there have been a couple great stories I've read in the Times and the Washington Post where they've pointed out some of the comments that many of these senators, Republican and Democrat alike, made when they're on the opposite side of this argument. And we've seen Senator Chuck Schumer's comments quoted quite a bit, Senator Grassley, Senator Hatch, and Senator Leahy as well, all of whom.
And President Obama as well.
And President Obama, that's right. All of whom sounded a little bit different when they were on the opposite side of this. And I don't have Leahy's the Leahy quotes in front of me right now, but certainly during the Bush years, he argued against confirming many of Bush's judges, especially towards the end of Bush's time in office. Now, he did, as he's pointed out, he's voted for people like Scalia himself. I think that was a 98-0 vote. He voted for Justice John Roberts. This is just how it's going to be, right? And frankly, it's both parties are equally guilty of this sin of seeing things through a different lens when it's their own president.
Leahy's up for re-election this year. In your column, you talked about perhaps a challenger from Scott Milne. What's he saying?
Well, Milne is saying the same thing he said for a while now, which is he doesn't really know what he's going to do. He says that most things are still on the table except for run for governor. So he says he could run for lieutenant governor, he could run for state senate, and he very well might run for the U.S. Senate. It seems that he has done some polling recently. I've gotten a lot of reports from people who received the poll. He won't deny it. He won't confirm it. But I think that it's something that Scott Milne is looking at fairly seriously. And it's hard to say what kind of how well he'd do against Leahy. I mean, I think nobody really expected him, or a lot of people didn't think he'd do very well against Peter Shumlin. Of course, he came incredibly close to actually winning. So I wouldn't count Scott Milne out. Leahy is certainly a lot more popular than Governor Shumlin. He's got a ton of resources at his disposal. I want to say something like 2.7 million, but I could be off there by a little bit. But he's got cash. He's got a great political operation. I think the question is whether it will be fired up. You would know better than I. But the last time he faced a really competitive race was when Governor Douglas challenged him. Right.
Right. That was the last time.
What year was that? 92.
It was 1992.
Yeah. So it's been a while since he's had a real challenge.
What do you think? And this is getting into the sort of the Terry Hallenbeck article in 7 Days this week, and I urge you to read 7 Days this week. There's a lot of good political news in there. It talking about Vermont Clinton fans treading sort of lightly. Do you think Leahy gets any blowback for his support of Clinton instead of Sanders in this presidential race?
It's a really good question, and I don't think so, but I could be wrong about that. So I think that there has been some immediate blowback to him, to Governor Shumlin, to who else? Those are the sort of major incumbents, I believe, that have endorsed Secretary Clinton. People have short memories, though. I don't know this is going to be something that will be on people's minds come November. Just doesn't seem likely to me. The other thing is that there's a difference between what Senator Leahy has been doing and what Governor Shumlin has been doing. Shumlin traveled out to Iowa to campaign for Clinton. Shumlin traveled several times to New Hampshire to campaign for Clinton. Leahy's kept a pretty low profile. He endorsed Clinton very, very early on. He says it was before he had any idea that Sanders was getting into the race, and he's kept fairly quiet about it since. You don't see him stumping for Clinton. So, I'm just reading into things here, but I think that's him perhaps showing a bit of respect to his Senate colleague. So I don't know that he'll really face the ire of the Bernie Sanders revolution. Although, if this presidential race ends up being very, very close and is decided because of superdelegate votes, then that could be a bigger problem for him because, of course, he is one of those superdelegates, and he pledged on Monday again to remain a superdelegate for Clinton pretty much no matter what happens.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us today. Hey, can you do this for me? Can you take some of Paula and Pamela's money and put it on 31 Black for me, please?
31 Black, I'll head right back down to the table. Sure, I'm on it.
Paul Hines, political editor of 7 Days. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul.
Yeah, no problem. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you. Up next, let's turn to the topic of Apple and whether they should or should not release some of their encryption data to the FBI. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're going to try to get this subject in. I promised this for the last couple of days, and I want to try to get it in. So if you have an opinion, you have a comment about this subject, which is Apple will fight the FBI in court on the encryption controversy, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Get your call in real soon so that we don't run out of time with your phone calls at the top of the hour. If you haven't been following this story, Apple CEO Tim Cook says that his company will fight a federal judge's order to help the FBI hack into the encrypted iPhone that belonged to the California shooter, the San Bernardino shooters. The company said if they did that, that it could potentially undermine the encryption of millions of other users. What they say is that they would be handing a tool to the federal government that would, in essence, give them the master key to a backdoor to open up the iPhones. Obviously, the government's response is that these are terrorists. We need to know who they've been calling, when they've been calling various people. And so this sets up a legal fight between the federal government and Apple. And so the question that I have for you, who is right in this fight? Is it Apple? Is it the FBI? And just to give you some background, what is happening is that, you know, there's a number code on the iPhone. So the FBI could easily run through various combinations and probably in a few days or even a few hours, probably unlock that combination. But the phone is programmed to wipe itself clean after the number of wrong guesses. And that's where Apple comes in. The feds want the tech company to build them a custom iPhone operating system minus the security features like auto wipe. And here's the problem Apple has. Apple's feels that effectively their engineers are being constricted to build forensic software, a hacking app, if for better, you know, for better words, for the FBI. And that's like ordering a locksmith to help crack a safe or you know, those sort of things. And Apple is refusing. And just interested in your thoughts. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Who's right in this and who's wrong? Is it Apple or FBI? Let's go to Bob in Plainfield. Bob, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mike. I don't know that this is true or not, but I thought I heard where the shooter didn't own the phone. Either the municipality or the state of California did. Did you hear that?
I did hear that from Ellen Ratner. I have not seen that in... I read a New York Times article today, and I read a New York Post article today on this. And, of course, every morning I sort of get a capsule version of the news, and I haven't seen that. But Ellen Ratner brought that up yesterday. But even if it did, does it make a difference?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I think the solution's fairly easy, and I am for privacy, is that they simply give the phone to Apple, they unlock it and give it back. That way they're not relinquishing any secrets or any of their technology, and the government gets what maybe they need to take a look further into this case. What do you think?
Well, that's an interesting concept. And my understanding is, I read some of the background, and who knows, Bob, what the background, whether it's true or not. Apple offered that, and the FBI wanted the encryption code. So I don't know who's right, who's wrong on that. But, it you know, the interesting thing, Bob, I for some reason I'm queasy about this, about giving the encryption code to the FBI.
I agree entirely. I don't think they should. If, on the other hand, they had the opportunity to unlock it without sacrificing any of their secrets, they should do it.
You're absolutely right. Thank you for your call, Bob. Let's go to Jerome in Barrie. Jerome, you're on Open Mic.
Good morning, Mike. I'm going to disagree with you.
That's fine.
The FBI is right. We are at war with terror.
That,
no holds barred. We need to get off our lily pad, give up some of our rights, or we're not going to enjoy, or our grandchildren are not going to enjoy our way of life. We need to use every tool to defeat these terror groups, ISIS in particular.
You know, Jerome, I am between feelings on this, and I don't know where I'm going on this, and I'm sort of asking the audience for some help on this, because I agree with you. We are at war. We are at war with terrorism. But what the Snowden case brought out in us is that the federal government will use all sorts of means in order to snoop on private citizens in Vermont and elsewhere in the country. And is that a good tool to give them? And I understand both sides here. I certainly do. And I'm trying to figure out a position here, but it absolutely makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable giving the federal government the key to get into every iPhone that there is in the world. What's your response to that?
Well, in regards to the Snowden case, I kind of agree with you, but if the government had gone to court to have that right to search those phones, then I'm all for it. But I think Apple's concern should be the right. I got my rich, sorry. The rights of those 14 victims and the rights of those families.
Yeah, and that's where I get hung up. You're absolutely right. I get
breaking into that phone, breaking the code, is going to prevent future attacks like that. I'm 100% for it.
Thanks, Jerome, for your phone call. Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic. Appreciate your opinion on this.
But basically, what we're looking at here is the FBI needs this to save lives. This is what they're saying, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so what wouldn't be the difference of taking away your guns if that would save lives?
So what you're saying is that I guess, Sam, the only reason I'm asking this is because I don't understand where you're going. You're saying that
if it's to save lives, the argument can be made we need to take the guns away also, because that will save lives. This is a key. This is a lock. The last caller said anything to save us from terrorists. Do we need to do internship camps like we did with the Japanese?
So you're saying...
Is that on the table also?
So you're saying not give them the lock is what you're saying, I think.
First of all, my feelings on it is it's government property. I don't even know why they're asking the question. It's government property that's owned by the county that guy worked for.
Yeah, and that's something I need to sort of sort out, because I haven't seen it in the news other than what Ellen Ratner said. Have you seen it someplace else that it was government property?
I read where they said that the phone was a authorized phone to him for his job that he was using.
So does it make a difference if it's government property to give the key to...
Well, it's a government agency on a government agency. I guess you can do with what you have with you. I think if they can do this to the point of it's, you know, they unlock... You know, I don't know what opens up when they do open this up. I'm not versed enough in this to figure that out, you know. You know, the sad part about it is the FBI, one of our best government agencies, can't figure out. I mean, what the heck?
Yeah, they should give it to a 12-year-old. That would probably open up the door. So, hey, Sam, thank you very much. We'll continue with open mic in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Boy, where does the time go here? We had another full program today. I appreciate all your phone calls. Great comments today. Great participation. Thank Paul Hines, the 7 Days political editor. And tomorrow, we're going to be back at the State House talking about various issues that legislators are talking about under the Golden Dome. And, of course, if you wish to hear this program again, go on to wdevradio.com. and our website and click on the Open Mic podcast icon, and then you'll find any show you wish to listen to. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News, AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And for all those people listening overseas and elsewhere in the country, WDEVradio.com.